United States. We do have a platinum mine in Salmon River. It is working. It is a pit mine. It goes down into the earth. It's not looking for placer deposits. And that is producing platinum. The issue of putting on offshore prospecting permits is what the committee should look at with a very, very close eye. If there are arguments raised that for strategic minerals, we need this resource. Certainly the United States Geological Survey has a 10-year plan now where they're going to be studying both strategic and precious minerals throughout the state of Alaska, and there will be other opportunities for platinum other than this particular area. I'll close right now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Are there questions by members of the committee? Mr. Sparks, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sparks, has there been any exploration work out there to try to determine what, if any, opportunities exist off the in the area that we're currently talking about closing?
Mr. Chairman, what type of exploration are we talking about? I'm unsure of the question.
Any kind of exploration to determine what might exist out in that area. I'm just trying to figure out if we have any idea of what kind of, say, platinum minerals or mineralogy might exist out there, and if you know of any exploration that's already taken place out there that might give us a clue.
All right, so you're talking about locatable minerals then, under the federal standard.
Affirmative.
The Taylor Quadrangle is subject for the next 3 years of investigation by the United States Geological Survey. That's an area east of the Good News Bay, in the Sleepy Quadrangle, it's called. It's about 160 miles upriver from the Kuskokwim area. And yes, there are locatable mineral deposits throughout the area that have been mined. They're under both the state and under BLM, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional comments, questions? If not, Representative DeVar.
Yeah, I have a question regarding your comments that there are other platinum prospects available in other areas, or that there will be others available. Can you discuss where those might be?
Well, the United States Geological Survey published a map, I believe it was 1984. What they were doing was they're doing aerial reconnaissance and known locatable minerals, and they had they believe that there is in the Kilbuck area other opportunities for platinum, and there a component of their 3-year Taylor Quadrangle survey, I think it's 1990 to 1992, will stretch down into the Kilbuck Range near Good News. So they are looking for shaft mining opportunities for platinum, and certainly it is on their agenda to find such a find such deposit.
But those are prospective, I guess. They're not identified.
Yes, they're just as speculative as this OPP proposal being made to DNR.
Thank you.
Additional comments, Representative Davis.
Yeah, just so I know that the existing mining that takes place in Good News now produces, and I don't need to know that information, but how many ounces per year currently, and also that's good enough.
I think Mr. Smith will probably have some of that information when he comes to forward.
Do we know that? Do we know that figure? How much it produces today?
They're not operating today.
They're not operating at all.
They're doing some exploration work on the deep placer ground, and they're doing repair on the dredges, but I don't know that they've had any production. They've had small amounts of production, maybe 100 ounces.
There's existing claims, but they're not.
There's existing claims. They're trying to get them into production, but there's no production today that we're aware of.
And I guess the other question, and we don't need that, but I was curious what the revenue would be to the state if these claims would be produced. That I know you.
Would you please come forward, Mr. Gallagher? For those of you on the network, we've had a couple of questions. You've heard the questions, and Mr. Gallagher gave an answer, and he's going to continue an answer for the second question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, the revenues on offshore prospecting permits and leases are 6I-based revenues. When the 6I bill was passed, it included offshore, so that would be 50 cents an acre in rental and 3% a net in the royalty.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Furness?
Well, Mr. Gallagher is here. Just one quick question. Just one, for the record, who maintains ownership of this land?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness This land is under state ownership out to the 3-mile limit as shown on that map in red. The OPP applications that have been on file since 1982 are owned by Karen Sheardown, an Anchorage resident.
But the I guess the point I want to make is it is state land.
That is correct.
Under
state
lease
land.
To...
Under application under to application. A citizen, yes.
Representative Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you aware of any drilling prospecting on any of these proposed leases to establish mineral traces or whatever?
Yes, the lease that was issued in 1970 and lapsed in 1976, if I can outline it for you here.
Please do so.
It was right about here, within the bay. To convert to a lease, you have to demonstrate to the department that you have what's called a workable mineral deposit. To support that demonstration, you have to provide us with the drilling and reserve estimates and all of the data you have. We have that data. That data is confidential by law. We cannot release it. I should note that even though we have that data and it indicates mineral deposit there within the bay, we have not proposed to lease that specific site. We've excluded that. Outside of the bay, the Bureau of Mines conducted reconnaissance exploration, bottom sampling, released a report about 8 months ago, and there was platinum indications in their sampling.
Thank you.
I would like to carry on here. We're running out of time. It has been the desire of the chair to extend this meeting until 5:30. Next, I'd like to hear from Mr. James Smith in Good News Bay, and then Frank Chingalak in Good News Bay, and then I'd like to come back to Juneau and hear from Tony Smith and Mr. Phil Holtz, Commissioner Holdsworth, and then I'd like to go back to Anchorage. We will get to you people if we can, please. Mr. James Smith in Good News Bay, are you there?
Hello, my name is James Smith. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm representing the Traditional Village Council, and I'm also the board member of Quichauk Corporation. My concerns have been covered by John Oscar and Bernard Babylon, who's point of the priority on is the subsistence, and therefore we have to protect the subsistence, which the village of Mongtop relies on heavily through us a year. And the other is the economy. When it comes to economy, the commercial fisheries is the only money producer in the district, not only for our Good News Bay and Plant, but for other villages that come down in the spring and summer to fish for herring and salmon. Therefore, we have to encourage the growth of the fisheries rather than endanger it by mining or drilling. When activities are happening like that, it disturbs not only the fish and wildlife, but there's other water life that the fish and birds rely on for food resource. And if you take any of this away within years, it won't be the same. Maybe the fish or other animals would get other habitat area for feeding. Therefore, it's very important that we shouldn't allow the mining to happen. And like I stated, most of it has been covered by Tom Oscar and Bernard and other guys. I thank them for their participation in this. And I have to make this brief. And once again, I would like to thank you for the opportunity. And
thank you, Mr. Smith. Representative Davis, you have a question? If not, please, Mr. Frank Chingalak. I hope I didn't mispronounce your name. Frank, are you there?
Yes, for the record, my name is Frank
livelihood of the people living around the area, around the Good News Bay area, heavily depends on the bay, the Good News Bay, also the areas beyond south and north of the bay, and also the resources from the bay, the salmon, the herring, also the support assistance on the resistance side. The livelihood of the area consists of a high percentage from the bay and through commercial fishing, as indicated, through subsistence cod resources available only from the bay. The marine mammals, seabirds, and also the salmon cod from subsistence fishing. Many years ago, the elders of the area were herders of reindeer and caribou that heavily roamed the area, but then since people have been having this area and traveling through by plane, boats, snow machine, we don't see any more of the animals. I'm just using this as an example to put through the for the bay site. If there's a mining, if there would be mining from the at the bay, this would adversely affect the resources coming through the bay and from areas beyond the bay and Platinum. I would like to make this very brief, and I'd like to thank all the others that testified on behalf of HB 332.
Thank you, Mr. Chingdek. Are there questions by members of the committee? If not, I'd like to come back here to Juneau and ask Mr. Tony Smith to offer his testimony.
Hello, are we still on the line?
Yes, you're still on the line. We're going to hear from Mr. Tony Smith now, who will be testifying from Juneau. If you would, please, Tony, offer your... Please give us your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Smith. I represent Good News Resources, Inc., who in the present process is allowed to go forward, and H.R. 332 is defeated. We'll be involved in the exploration and hopefully the development of these prospects. Mr. Chairman, I have prepared written testimony, and I would ask that that be incorporated in the record, particularly in light of the fact that it's 10 minutes to 5, and to save time, if that would be all right, I just would like to make some comments instead of reading for the record on my testimony.
As you wish, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just, Mr. Chairman, respond to some of the concerns and ask the committee to look at the appendage to my testimony, which is the letter from Good News Resources to Mr. David Case, the attorney representing the people in Platinum and Good News Bay, laying out 10 concepts which my client desired to discuss with the local people, including recognition of the problems within Good News Bay and relinquishment of rights, stipulations on permits, environmental and biological studies, employment, job training, scholarships, contractor preference, lease of village corporation lands, area management committee. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Good News Resources Inc. is an Alaska company which is a sensitive company and understands the importance of the subsistence lifestyle and the subsistence resource in Good News Bay, and does not come before you now opposing H.R. 332 as a company that has been insensitive to the needs of the people in the area. I'd like to point out for the committee that in 1984, when Wishbone Hill was under consideration up in the Matanuska Valley, that the testimony was uniformly in opposition to going forward with that mining prospect. Yet in today's world, the local residents are the strongest supporters of Wishbone Hill that we see, and that the Matsu Borough has is involved in tremendous efforts to help bring that mine into production. So I think that, I've known Harold for a long time, Harold Sparks, and the feeling that mining companies are somehow bad, I would submit to my client that that's an incorrect assumption, and that the basis of a policy decision by this committee on some fear that that's the situation is just not warranted, particularly in this instance. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, we have under Title 38 a process for balancing all of the various interests when a offshore permit or a mining lease is to be processed, and that process has been working in this case. Public input is certainly one of the parts of that process, but I submit to you that often there are state, regional, and perhaps national interests that also weigh in that process. I think we've heard from Fish and Game, and if you look at the record, you'll see the Department of Environmental Conservation has also been involved in the process, and the mitigating factors, the sensitivity to the concerns of the people, justified concerns from their perspective as to the subsistence resource, have been taken into account, and a number of tracts have been deleted. And again, I point out that my client is not opposing that, but has in fact asked the people for the opportunity to meet with them and to work on these particular issues so that in fact the development can take place in a sound environmental manner. This is an important prospect. It is an important mineralized area. It is one of the two areas in the United States where platinum is available. The other one, as I understand it, is Yellowstone, and it's not, the National Park, and is not of the same quality or magnitude as is the case in this particular situation. It is a mineral that went from precious to industrial because of the need to use platinum in the catalytic converter. We presently import 3.8 million ounces of platinum, over half or approximately half from South Africa, the balance from the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. And it is a strategic metal at this time. Point out to you that the catalytic converter and that whole effort is an effort to control air pollution, and it was really the Clean Air Act that resulted in platinum becoming a resource in great demand. I submit to you that to politically, and I believe that's what's being asked, to politically overturn the statutory and regulatory process for balancing all of the various interests is a policy mistake for the legislature to make. When I was commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development, one of the things that the governor did and that I was sent out to do was to get across to the mineral industry that if a mining company was willing to be a good citizen and to develop prospects in accordance with our environmental statutes and regulations, that we wouldn't play gotcha with them and wait until they spend a great deal of money and effort complying with our process and then come in on a political basis and overturn the process. And I submit to you that the ongoing process with the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Fish and Game, and the Department of Environmental Conservation is working, is the appropriate process, and is taking into consideration those issues that have been expressed by the people in the area, and ensuring that in fact their concerns are recognized or involved and are reflected in the ultimate outcome. Because of the time limitation, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make a couple of comments on two other issues. Dredging is something we do in Dillingham to keep the port open, on St. Paul Island to build a harbor, in Nome to allow the fleet to use the port, in Anchorage to let ships come in. dredging as a aid to navigation is something that is done in this state and around the United States with a great deal of regularity. And you don't, the same kinds of concerns, as soon as you say mining, people's perceptions change. Now, the platinum mining that is envisioned in the particular offshore prospects is pure and simple moving dirt through dredging. It is not an amalgamation process, and I'll leave that to Phil Holdsworth, who knows a lot more about mining than I do. But this is not a situation where there are additional risks because of the fact that you would be dredging for the purposes of obtaining platinum any more than if you were dredging to open a channel. In addition, as a result of the BEMA's activity in Nome and studies conducted by the Mineral Management Service, the Indian Health Service, and the Norton Sound Health Corporation, we now have data that shows that in fact the suspected or concerned risk of mercury contamination is not there. That the present documented evidence that has just come in the last 30 days indicates that mercury is not a problem, and high levels of mercury are not a problem. And in addition, we have baseline data that mercury as a trace metal in the Kuskokwim Yukon area is not a problem. So that the concern that somehow this activity, if it goes forward under the constraints that we've all heard that will be imposed by Fish and Wildlife or Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources, is not the concern that some people thought it would be. And that is something that is part of the existing process, and I submit to you is an ongoing scientific and technical effort that should be left to the process that is contained in Title 38. I believe that, Mr. Chairman, you and the members of the committee should recognize that it would be a real mistake in terms of Alaska's diversified economy to politically set aside by precluding the present process to work and any mining in this area to set aside and basically mothball this important prospect and mineralized area by politically naming it a critical habitat. I don't think it's justified by the facts. And certainly my client continues to want to work with the people who testified to make sure that in fact this is a model project. Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Smith, Representative Davis, then Representative.
Well, Tony, I appreciate your testimony. I think that we certainly have competing interests here as far as how to decide on, you know, whether one, that we can provide an environment where there can be other activities take place other than the current ones. And one of the things I think this committee is looking at, along with other committees, is the fact that even if a company does comply with all the environmental restrictions, doesn't protect the environment necessarily. And that's one reason why we're going to be probably relatively busy this year, because we may need to put additional restrictions on certain companies that are doing business in the state of Alaska. I understand people's concern that that maybe that an enlightened company trying to do everything they can to be sensitive to the people in the area still may not be sufficient to protect what they consider to be something that could do irreparable harm to what they have out there. So I think I can understand where they're coming from out there, and where, I mean, if I was someone that lived in this area, it'd take a lot for me to develop a level of trust, and so I I appreciate what your company is trying to do, and I also have a real appreciation for the people wanting to make sure the current resources are not harmed.
Representative Furness.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to request, my packet did not include the letter from Good News Resources, Inc., nor the letter preceding that, David S. Case. I'd like to have that information.
Did you get this packet?
I got the packet, Mr. Chairman.
But you say in the back of it, you did not get...
It was not included. The only thing my packet contained was the Mr. Smith's...
State Representative Furness, there's one. I believe it's there. Kent Dawson and I apologize. Of course, it's somebody else's fault. I don't know which one of us put together your packet.
So, are you taking care of Representative Furness?
Yeah, the other question is to you, Mr. Chairman. What is your intent on this legislation for today?
My intent on this legislation today is to continue on with the testimony and take this up as the next order of business if... we can on the next day that I chair this committee.
All right, then I'll hold my questions to that time. Then. Thank you.
Additional comments or questions? Mr. Smith, you indicated that you saw that there would not be a problem in working with the people yet. It's my understanding, according to Mr. Gallagher, the process is not yet complete. Does that mean that you anticipate then no other issues or factors that would in fact deter your client from their present feelings about this project?
Mr. Chairman, my client, extends the offer to work with the people, which was categorically refused by their attorney in the past. I'm still very desirous of that. The process, as I understand it at this point in time, would be the issuance of a best interest finding with all the restrictions and deletion of certain areas and potential areas. And then there would be a number of permits required, and there'd be a number of continuing processes to work with the people, the local people, as we go forward. And I heard what Harold Spark says, and my client is desirous of working with the people out there to ensure that they can do this project in a sensible and environmentally sound manner with the support of the local community. We think it's a good project for everybody.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would like to differ with Mr. Smith on a couple of points. We are elected people, and we represent constituencies, and we have to work and develop a public policy. And the question at hand, we've heard today testimony from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta area, which is approximately 180,000 square miles, or a little bit larger than the state of Washington, from several groups, AVCP, Noonan Clue Speech Fisheries Organization. Not one of these people testified in support of this legislation. And it seems as though they have very, very valid concerns about their lifestyle, the threatening of their lifestyle versus the interest of one corporation. And that may provide jobs for a 10-year period whereby this ecosystem has provided a livelihood for generations and generations. And I think that is the question at hand. It is not purely and simply a political solution. We are policymakers, and there is a vast number of people out there that feel that this is in their best interest. And I think that the good of the many in this case outweighs the good of the few.
That's true. Thank you. One moment, I've got a couple of people before you. In regards to public policy, Mr. Smith, we know that despite the opportunities for offering balanced solutions or certainly input to the process that Title 38 offers us, that even today as we march into the modern era, there are new tools being developed and utilized by people with more experience in environmental risk assessment. And I was wondering if your client, in fact, has examined any of those tools, if, in fact, you have done an adequate risk analysis as regards to what you feel the trade-off would be if this project that your client is interested in were to go on.
Mr. Chairman, I have not brought that specific question up with my client, but I'd be glad to do that and get back to you. I believe that based on the process as it's working right now and the requirements of fishing game and DEC, that in fact, and the willingness of my client to work with those restrictions rather than try to get around them, because that's important. I mean, the expression in that letter is a willingness to work with the problem, not to try to do anything that would sidestep that process. And we're very comfortable with DEC, ADFNG, and the DNR process. And at this point in time, feel that all of those considerations are on the table, and that the departments are doing an excellent job. Other than one thing, there are people that are opposed to it, and the process is still going forward. And I submit that I can show you across the state with various kinds of development where people have been opposed, local people have been opposed to the development, often because of a lack of understanding of the specific project itself, but a perceived fear, and later found that when policymakers exercised their judgment, the correct judgment, that people find that their fears were unfounded. And I believe that that is the situation you will find in this instance.
Mr. Smith, I would continue to submit that in the matter or issue of environmental risk assessment, which admittedly is a newer area, but it's always been with us, but we know that the academic world is going forward with these kinds of basic tools. One of the first things we do in environmental risk assessment is to make an attempt to educate the local population as to what the risk and what the assessment is and how it balances out. And I don't think that means just talking to those people, but I guess I still have the question. What has your client done, in fact, to initiate this kind of education, this kind of informational exchange regards environmental risk assessment toward the local population?
Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Jerry Gallagher to answer part of it. I know we paid for a tape in UPIC to explain to the people in their own language what was going on and what the process was all about. I know that the consultants who have been retained to do the analysis out there were people and companies recommended and directed by Department of Natural Resources, Fishing, Game, and DEC, and my client did not try to second guess that or bring in other companies. And we, as I say, were concerned enough about ensuring that the local people understood what was going on, so that there is a tape which I have with me, and I think Jerry has a copy, but we can leave a copy in UPIC so that the members of the committee, it's a half an hour tape, in light of our time constraints. I don't know that the committee wants to do, but if any member of the committee or any of the staff want to see this, we'd be glad to do it. Anything else, Jerry?
I don't know if we have any UPIC speakers on the committee, but
please,
Mr. Gallagher, go ahead.
Just as an example, first of all, to sort of put this in perspective, we don't know if there's a platinum deposit there. The exploration hasn't been conducted. We have learned a fair amount about the fish and wildlife resources and the human resources, but we don't know everything there is to know there either.
Do we know enough to know that this project absolutely would minimize any risk to that resource?
We believe, and that map I showed you, that in those areas we could minimize the risk. Now, what we have also stipulated in here, in our proposal, is that, for instance, one thing we're not sure of. The Department of Fish and Game says, hey, we know the fish migrate up and down the coast. At Nome, that analysis has been done, and we know that 300 feet from the coast, that's where they are, and that's the area to protect. Here, we have proposed to stipulate that the mining company do sonar analysis under the direction of the Department of Fish and Game to determine whether they migrate at 100 feet, 500 feet, or a mile. We don't have that information right now. We have stipulated in there that they continue to collect during this initial 10-year phase data on heavy metals. There's a number of these sorts of requirements. Based on that, we will use that at lease conversion, if they do believe they have a mineral deposit, to either issue, reject, or modify, further stipulate that lease. So that's a real environmental assessment, because we'd be dealing with real data. We wouldn't have to build hypotheses on hypotheses.
But that data is not yet available.
No, and we have the mechanism to build it in and to account for it.
So you're asking that these people then, I guess I'm getting a feeling here of a risk that were I living in Good News Bay, or perhaps even either of you, you might feel differently about this. So here we have real environmental risk analysis, the tools of which you spoke, Mr. Gallagher, yet you're not make the protections that House Bill 332 makes. Is that correct?
I don't believe we've asked you to do one thing or another.
Okay. Mr. Senator, do you have an additional comment?
On that particular issue, Mr. Chairman, on what you have is a process where Mr. Gallagher's identified some risk assessment analysis that needs to be done, which my client is going to have to do as part of the process, the DNR. And that is the problem with what's proposed in HB 332, is that the ongoing process says in order for you to prospect, to explore, and that's a long way from to develop, you are going to have to do the sonar type of analysis so we know where it is, and that's part of your permit, that's part of your requirement. And I submit that sitting here in Gross, looking at the policy, to just say, no, you can't mine, instead of saying we've got a process that will ensure that risk assessment is done, and if the assessment says that there's a problem with the salmon, then we're not going to be able to do things that we would otherwise hope to be able to do. And the question whether the bureaucracy will take those actions is demonstrated by the fact that they have deleted a number of prospects in the course of the last 2-year process. So I think what you're looking for, Mr. Chairman, is a situation where we have a model that is working. And it's a terrible statement to make to industries, resource industries in this state, that if you comply with our involved process to ensure that you protect the resource, we'll still come along politically and knock you out of the game. I think that's a bad policy.
Well, certainly a terrible dilemma we're here. Representative Poppin, and then Representative Hudson, and then Representative Furness.
Again, I guess the policy, it may be a bad policy, but we're talking about setting policy for people of a whole region, the whole Yukon Custom Delta area, over 160,000 square miles larger than the state of Washington, are opposing this proposed exploration, and they're so concerned about it, they went ahead and asked that this be set aside. You know, the whole, not only Good News Bay, but members of the Association of Village Council Presidents, which represent close to 50 villages, resource group agencies, and today to testify in support of it is a Good News Bay resource company that has an address in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wrestling with the fact that this is not just another gold dredging operation. This is a very, very precious and I think the only major platinum find in North America. And I think that elevates it in my mind more than just a question of whether or not we should shut it down totally without even finding out to what extent it might be. If it were gold, I think I would have already concluded with the maker of this legislation. I think I would have simply said, that's it. You've surely showed me enough. But I'm a little concerned, and I would like to hear a little bit more about just exactly what a little more about the platinum itself and about the national security aspects of that whole thing. You know, we have here, and I can understand the people that live there, because they probably don't have a vested interest in the mine. They're probably not getting a whole lot of earnings from the mine or things of this nature. And maybe they're rightfully concerned about what damage it might do. But I think that there is a process, and the process tries to protect the very things they want, and maybe in the final analysis says, that's just it, you don't do it out there, folks, regardless of what you find. But I'm weary a little bit about shutting down the process by creating the establishment of some sort of a reserve that absolutely outlaws any activity in that area without having a greater understanding of the offsetting national interest and perhaps even interest to the state of Alaska and perhaps even to those folks out there. And that's my concern. If it were gold, I believe I would have already signed off on this, quite frankly, because I think that even the overriding interest of the people in the area there would say that's good enough for me. But I think this is a pretty unique area of the world, a pretty unique mineralogy, and I'd like to know more about it.
Well, there you have it, Mr. Smith. If you know somebody that can inform the committee more about the importance of platinum and other issues related as Representative Hutt's name, perhaps you can get that information to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know Commissioner Holdsworth is more knowledgeable about the mining industry than I am. And I also will endeavor to obtain the requisite information from the U.S. Bureau of Mines and some of the experts in the field and provide it in written comments, if that's all right, to the committee.
Thank you.
And I, of course, would give Representative Hoffman a copy of anything.
Thank you. That would be appreciated. Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need a little help, perhaps, from Representative Hoffman, understanding the geography. As I read the material, I understand that there's a community named Good News Bay. Is there a community named Platinum?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
Good News Bay is up here, and Platinum is down here.
I assume that the region is known as the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
Yes.
Okay. How many people reside in that region, or the
Yukon-Kuskokwim
Delta?
ABCP, I think, represents about 20,000 people.
Okay. My next question is, to your knowledge, are there any documented environmental risks noted to date having to do with this project?
I'd have to defer that question to someone else.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to move on. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Appreciate your testimony. Today, I would like to go first. I'm going to hear from Commissioner Holdsworth. Then I would like to go to Anchorage, and then I would like to wait until tomorrow to finish up this bill. So, next.
the record, my name is Joel Holdsworth, and I'm speaking for the Alaska Miners Association. You have in your packet a very short statement, a page and a few lines on the second one. And I'll just touch lightly on those because I would like to cover some of the points that have been spelled out here. Goodness Bay District has provided the only platinum produced in the United States beginning in 1916, with the annual production increasing to 37,000 ounces in a 6 month period in 1938. That was the second year of the Goodness Bay Mining Company's production after they got their dredges. And production continued until 1975 before it shut down. And as been previously stated, there is presently no operation up there in that district in platinum mining. There is no interest, of course, in the area. As has been stated, that platinum is a critical and strategic metal, and 93% of the nation's requirements are imported from South Africa, the United Kingdom, and Russia. And renewed interest has been expressed in this area for platinum discoveries. The U.S. Bureau of Mines and the U.S. Geological Survey have conducted extensive surveys in this mining district in recent years, indicating potential reserves, and have published their findings. Those findings are available. And this is a very extensive exploration by both the Bureau of Mines and Geological Survey. They have indicated reserves on both onshore and offshore lands. And they have actually stated the tonnage potential that they have inferred reserves. Now, the best example of the present-day mining technology practiced by the industry is best described in the Bema dredging operation offshore of Nome. Production has been ongoing for the past three seasons and has had no adverse effects on the fishery. Environmental consequences of West Coast Nome offshore placer project after 4 years of study. Made these studies before they started going into production, include the following, and these are the questions that were raised by much of the testimony from out in Bristol Bay and in the Goodness Bay area. After 2 to 3 years, substrate, now this is answering questions that were raised by the people in the field, substrate types occur in the same proportion as surrounding areas. In other words, the substrate is just the same where they're doing their mining as it is in other areas around that haven't been mined. They have been forming no plumes, anything, you know, of turbidity, anything to come up and interfere with the normal conditions. No change in oxygen concentration in the water column. No change in trace metal concentrations of 8 priority metals. same metals that everybody's been talking about in this whole testimony. There's been no change in those from the way it was before they started. Within 3 years, recolonization community structure is similar to control areas. Community appears to be moving through successional maturation process. Now this is the communities they're talking about is all the fish and all this sort of thing and the movements throughout the area. No avoidance of mined areas by king crab. King crab are there, they haven't been disturbed, they're still moving around in the same area that they're dredging. No trace metals being concentrated in king crab, fish, or king crab food items. Community recovery based on existing database is estimated at less than 5 years for the sand substrate to get back to its original position and 7 years for cobble substrates. Now the cobble, of course, is the larger particles of rock, boulders and so on, and of course we do have that in areas in the offshore, particularly in the type of deposit that's been formed by glaciation of the particular load deposit moved it all out in large size, and it's mixed up with the planted material. And it should be pointed out that platinum metal does not amalgamate with mercury. Its recovery is simply a gravity concentration process where the concentrates shipped to a refinery. So you don't have the same situation that you have with recovery of gold, for example, as has been mentioned, and where they do amalgamate it for recovery purposes. So there's the only mercury that's in that area at all, of course, is the source of it is the Kuskokwim Valley, which is the main source, natural source of all the mercury in the waters in that whole area. So the Alaska Miners Association is opposed to this type of legislation in which by creating a critical habitat area close to mineral entry and mineral leasing would prevent the production of a critical and strategic metal such as platinum. And this is not in the best interest of the state and the nation.
Thank you, Mr. Holdsworth. Questions, Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Phil, earlier someone, and I can't remember who it was now, testified about the concern for arsenic, mercury, and I think it was cadmium or cadmium.
Cadmium.
Are these naturally found in these substrata, and what effect does dredging have in that respect?
Well, that's the one item number three in the list that I have prepared there.
No change
in trace metals, and those are all listed, of course, in their report. This information is all available, and they list all of those minerals, the metals, so that there's been no change in the content during the period of their operations so far. No change from the natural original situation.
Additional questions, comments? Thank you, Mr. Holdsworth. Appreciate your testimony. I did have a question, perhaps maybe for Fishing Game rather than yourself, but I would like to have your thoughts on it. We know that in Nome, they're not mining there, I understand, around an estuary. And so we have a situation where the comparative analysis of this area is a little bit different than what we would have for, say, someplace in Good News Bay, and I was wondering if you had comments in that regard.
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, it's very evident that the agreement that's been reached now on between DNR and Fish and Game about the areas that would be possibly accepted as applications, we agree with that because they have gone through the process of determining whether or not it would interfere with the eelgrass and all the rest of the resources in there. And so we agree, in other words, that the areas which they have not classified as being available and suitable for testing under a prospect permit is proper.
Thank you, Mr. Holdsworth. Did the department have a comment on that?
Not at this time, Mr. Chairman, but we'd be glad if you're going to reconvene this discussion tomorrow or so, but we'd be glad to try to get some updated information on the comparison between the two areas.
It is the intent of the chairman to continue this conversation on House Bill 332 on next Tuesday. And so with that, I would like to hear from two more people in Anchorage, if you would please keep your comments short. First, I think, is Karen Woods. Would you please, Karen, or Ms. Woods, would you please come forward in Anchorage if you're still there and offer your testimony? Oh, you're on 409, I'm sorry. So we'll hold off on that, Karen, just a moment, please. With that, I would like to announce then that we will continue this committee hearing in about 2 minutes, and we'll have a stretch, and then we'll go on to House Bill 409. Back to order of the House Resources Committee. We will continue on with House Bill 409, and first we'll hear from the Assistant Attorney General, Michelle Brown. Please, Ms. Brown, if you would.
Thank you.
State your name, please, for the record.
I'm Michelle Brown, an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm here primarily to answer any questions you may have about how the provisions of this bill would work in the field and what the provisions mean for an enhanced prevention program. My perspective is basically one of one who's been in the trenches and what's worked and what hasn't worked. I'll briefly discuss each section in the bill and what it's meant to address.
Excuse me, Ms. Brown, before you continue, I must explain to the committee that, first of all, I would explain that we have only four members of the committee here, and we have a problem in that we have a committee substitute that has been worked off of from the original bill, and I would like to get the committee substitute before this committee. But in view of the fact that we have not had the committee substitute before the committee before, I would like to know if there's objection in adopting the committee substitute and work from that bill. Is there any objection?
No objection, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis?
No objection.
So that means that before us is committee substitute for House Bill 409. Please proceed, Ms. Brown.
Thank you. Section one of this bill, authorizes DEC to conduct inspections of those facilities which are subject to its jurisdiction to ensure compliance with state law. The former language required consent of the facility, even though the facility is already permitted by DEC and is a pervasively regulated industry. The point of the change is to authorize DEC to have immediate access, and it does away with language that authorizes a delay in granting access. It's delay that causes the loss of evidence of any violation of state law, and that's what this is designed to correct. This change also makes DEC's authority consistent with that of the EPA, DEC's federal counterpart. Should I continue with each section, and if there's questions you may have?
What's the pleasure of the committee? If you have questions at the end of each section, I would just ask that you let me know, and then we'll answer those questions. If not, then are there any questions for section one? Please continue, Ms. Brown.
Thank you. Section two is a housekeeping measure that's necessary if the provisions of section five are accepted. Section three provides a new prevention and incentive program to DEC's currently rather limited enforcement powers. Right now, if there's a violation of an environmental law, DEC must go to a full-fledged court proceeding to seek any sort of financial sanction. And even those sanctions are limited to reimbursement to the state for costs or for damages to the environment or resources. This change adds an important component to DEC's prevention and enforcement authority by creating an administrative process which imposes a financial incentive to comply with state laws. Other state agencies already have similar authority, and the EPA has now uses administrative penalties as its predominant enforcement tool. The administrative penalties have proven effective in EPA actions by providing a real and quantifiable financial impact to breaching state environmental laws. This is particularly important, as I mentioned when I was here the other day, for those violations of state law which cause no direct environmental harm. For instance, the heart of a prevention program is the oil spill contingency planning and oil spill preparedness, but there's very little consequence now under state law for failing to adhere to those requirements. Administrative penalties have also proven in EPA actions to provide an efficient and a fair means to provide that financial incentive to comply. I would describe it as efficient and fair for two reasons. The first is that handling matters administratively rather than judicially is far more expeditious and cost-effective for both industry and the regulator. The procedure provides a much faster review of any proposed penalty than a court review would allow. The second reason is that it adds certainty to the process. Now, when DEC seeks a monetary assessment, it goes before whatever judge is assigned anywhere in the state. There's no consistency in the number and the amount of assessments opposed. Development of a solid administrative penalty criteria and establishing a consistent track record for when those penalties are imposed will add fairness and certainty to the process. This provision has been changed from the prior draft in the mostly as a procedural change. Originally, the first draft just set out the DEC's authority to impose administrative penalties. But because this is a fairly new procedure for DEC, this version will now set out the exact administrative procedure that will be adhered to in imposing administrative penalties. If there's no questions on Section 3, I'll go on to Section 4. Section 4 authorizes DEC to direct that environmental audits be performed. An environmental audit is like any other audit, financial or management. It brings in an objective person to fully evaluate whether an operation is running at its peak for preventing pollution. EPA uses audits extensively and has developed guidance on the subject. Audits are beneficial to both industry and the state because they spot problems early on before full-scale pollution develops. The other benefit is that it's considerably cheaper to conduct an audit, detect and correct a violation than it would before than the cost of when pollution occurs when pollution hits groundwater. And lastly, it benefits the state particularly because while we could seek damages for any environmental harm that's been caused by pollution, that will not truly make us whole. The only way we can ever be made whole is to prevent these incidents from occurring. Any questions? Section 5.
You're doing very well, apparently.
I'm trying to go
yes,
quickly.
Yes, thank you.
Section 5 changes the way the DEC's administrative cleanup orders work. Right now, DEC cannot administratively order that someone stop an ongoing pollution incident. DEC cannot order immediately effective a cleanup order so that a contaminated site cleanup will begin without some sort of lengthy and full-fledged hearing. This provision is distinct from any penalty imposition. This relates solely to stop pollution orders. And what this provision will allow for is that these orders will be effective immediately. Pollution will stop and cleanup will commence. Federal law authorizes this type of provision under the Clean Air Act, under CERCLA, and under the Clean Water Act. The purpose is to prevent delay from being introduced into the process when, in fact, our goal is to promptly eliminate risk to the public health and the environment. The provision does not curtail anyone's right to later contest liability or to seek contribution from others who might be responsible for the pollution. What it does is provide that cleanup commence immediately. All rights and liabilities can be litigated later, but the public doesn't have to bear the burden of that delay. These matters can be litigated and contribution can be made simultaneously to the cleanup taking place. And the problem is that the situation is reversed now. The public usually has to just wait until all these issues are sorted out in advance before cleanup will even begin. And lastly, Section 6 and 7 are also housekeeping measures that, if Section 5 is adopted, will need to be changed in the statutes.
Ms. Brown, so Section 5, the compliance order, this in effect then streamlines the confusion that we witnessed on March the 24th this last year of who was in charge and who's complying with what. Is that correct?
It streamlines the confusion because if you have several parties who are responsible, you can be issuing orders to all of them to start the cleanup and will later sort out the issue of who's responsible to pay what proportion of the cost. So the goal is to get cleanup going and to stop the pollution, and that happens first, and later we sort out these other issues.
Representative, Co-Chair Menard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brown, then, so the scenario that you described a few days ago when you testified before the Oil Spill Commission or the on oil spill legislation when we were reviewing that, the scenario that happened in the cooking spill and all the different scenarios of problems with litigation and who was doing what, and we still haven't come to a conclusion as far as settling those cases and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This will help enable this process at all, or has no bearing, or what?
This would not expedite private claims, if that's a threshold
yeah.
question. What this will do is expedite the cleanup and get everyone focused initially on the cleanup, and then the other issues will be sorted out later.
Please continue, Ms. Brown.
I have nothing
you
further.
You have nothing further? Questions. Additional questions or comments by members of the committee? Representative Davis?
No, no questions. I appreciate her walking through the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I apologize again for bringing you all the way down from Anchorage in such a hurried situation here. But
happy to do it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And next, I would like to continue on with the teleconference on 409. I must admit, I am somewhat puzzled that I do not have on my list here anyone from the industry. Is there anyone here from industry? Are you? No.
No comment tonight.
No comment tonight from industry. Is there going to be anyone from industry on Thursday when we continue this bill?
I'll find out and get back to you.
Okay, I would appreciate that.
We may continue it tomorrow, Mr. Chairman, after the Forest Practices Act. I think that.
My co-chair reminds me that instead of Thursday, we will continue after the Forest Practices discussion tomorrow evening. That's Wednesday, So if, please, the representative of industry would take note, I would appreciate you getting back to the chair to let us know if, in fact, industry does have a comment on this bill.
And Mr. Chairman, it probably would be around 3:30 is the kind of the timing we're looking at, 3:30, 4 o'clock.
Okay, thank you very much. Additional questions, comments by the committee? None? I'd like to go on to Anchorage, and I believe Ms. Karen Wood, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. This is Karen Wood. I speak on behalf of the Alaska Center for the Environment, which is an environmental group with approximately 1,000 members from around the state, but focused in the South Central region. I speak in strong support of the committee substitute to House Bill 409. We need strong laws to protect the environment, and we need to give our state agents strong regulatory tools if we want to see those laws enforced. Basically, I support everything that Ms. Brown said in walking through the bill. We believe that administrative penalties will increase the incentive not to pollute. They will streamline the penalty process. They will require fewer DEC resources in both time and money, and still provide a fair process to administer penalties to polluters and weigh the benefits. And I'd just like to emphasize again that administrative penalties are already used successfully by EPA. We support environmental audits and also the removal of pre-enforcement review requirements of compliance orders to further streamline the process. And I'd just like to remind the committee that in the Oil Spill Commission's report, I will quote directly from it. There's a paragraph that says, quote, regulatory effectiveness should be improved through assessment of administrative and civil penalties to encourage prevention. No pre-enforcement review of compliance orders, environmental audits, stronger criminal penalties, and statutory provision for citizen lawsuits. That's from page 22 of executive report of Bill of the Exxon Valdez. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Wood. Are there questions by members of the committee of Ms. Wood? Thank you. Next, Mr. Mike Wendig, are you there?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mike Wendig. I'm the staff attorney with Trustees for Alaska. I testified at your hearing on regulatory oversight last week very briefly, but I neglected to mention that several of our recommendations to improve regulatory oversight are addressed in House Bill 409. So I'd just like to say today that we fully support House Bill 409, and it will substantially improve DEC's ability to enforce the state's environmental laws. I'd just like to add that my perspective comes on this bill comes not only as an attorney for Trustees for Alaska, but as a lawyer who spent 4 years with the Justice Department defending the EPA's enforcement and other regulatory programs. And I can say that from my experience at the federal level, these administrative enforcement mechanisms were considered quite important, at least over the last two administrations, which were the period during which I worked in the federal government. I'd just like to read a few sentences from a report, EPA's fiscal year 1988 enforcement accomplishments report. Page 2 of that report, which I think may be in your packet, says, in the statutes that Congress has enacted or reauthorized over the past few years, EPA has been given expanded authority to use administrative enforcement mechanisms to address violations and compel regulated facilities to achieve compliance or take other corrective actions. Administrative enforcement tools permit the agency to impose penalties and direct regulated entities to undertake action to correct noncompliance in a less resource-intensive way than judicial remedies. And the report goes on to say that EPA enforcement programs are making substantial use of these tools. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we all know what kinds of resource constraints DEC is facing, and that is precisely why we need to strengthen DEC's administrative enforcement tools to make better use of DEC's limited resources. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Winning. Questions by members of the committee of Mr. Winning? No. At this time, I'd like to formally adopt Committee Substitute of House Bill 409. We do have a quorum present in the persons of Representative Navarre, Representative Jocko, Representative Davis, and co-chairs Menard and Davidson. So I would then move for adoption formally of the committee substitute. Is there objection?
No objection.
So that is officially the bill before us, and we will continue this meeting. First, I'd like to go along the teleconference network to see if there is anybody anywhere out there who would like to testify on House Bill 409. Is there anyone on the teleconference who would like to testify?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want to maybe for the people there in Anchorage to let them know that we'll be sending up the committee substitute to the Anchorage office, so that'll be available for tomorrow. So I guess if this comes up again tomorrow, they'll be able to see the committee substitute. So I'll make sure my office sends that up there.
Thank you, Representative Davis. With that, I would just like to remind the teleconference and the people listening here in Juneau, as well as the committee, that we will continue our business on House Bill 409 on approximately 3:30. And I would also formally like to add for the record that I would request a bill analysis with special delivery to Representative Furness.
Yes.
And we will not adjourn this. We will not adjourn the meeting, but we will continue this meeting tonight on the Moose hearing. So with that, the meeting is temporarily adjourned till 7 p.m.